So we last spoke about a little bit about the various targumim, particularly Unklus and Yonatan, and the different kinds of interpretation. The literal translation, the targum type A, Midrash, and finally Mishnah, which is totally independent from the text. How were targumim used? So what was the primary function of targum? I think it's the primary function. At least, not all targumim, but let's say targum unklus. No. It was used liturgically. It was used in the context of the basic Knesset when they read the Torah, so it was translated into the vernacular of the people. What people were speaking in Eretz Yisrael? What language were people speaking in Eretz Yisrael at the time of the Mishnah? Jews probably knew some Greek, but wasn't necessarily the spoken language, except for the very Hellenized Jews. They either spoke Aramaic or perhaps a dialect of Hebrew, akin to Mishnaic Hebrew. There was, for a long time, the assumption in scholarship, primarily Christian scholars, and this was certainly had an anti-Semitic bias in it, was that Hebrew was a dead language. It was no longer living during the time of the Mishnah. This is just a theme of how Christians are the successors to the biblical Jews, not the Jews. And one of the things that sort of plays into this is the fact that the language of the Jews, of the biblical Jews, and the language of the rabbinic Jews were not the same. Whereas in fact, it's pretty clear that Hebrew was spoken in some context. How widespread, we don't know. But during even after the Korban, we know this because the Bar Kokhba letters are written in a dialect of Mishnaic Hebrew. And you don't typically write letters in a language that people aren't speaking. A law code is different. You know, you can see throughout the medieval period, certainly, letters are, works are written in Hebrew, even for those who might be writing their, like the Rambam, who might be writing their Shelos and Shuvos in the vernacular. So it's conceivable you write certain kinds of works in Hebrew, but you know, regular letters of correspondence are not written, typically, in the language, unless you speak it. Yes. You got Kochba letters? I don't know. It's various people. Important people have correspondence. You can go take a course in the Dead Sea Scrolls. In this case, you literally are on the side of the devil. But yeah, if they were what? No. I know. Except for the guy on the other end wouldn't be able to read it. That's not the way things typically were done. So it's not like it wasn't encoded. They weren't encoded. Okay. So anyway, but it is clear that in Bavel and perhaps even most Jews in Eretz Yisrael were not speaking Hebrew, or their primary language was in fact Aramaic, and therefore the Targum was an Aramaic translation, so people would understand. You have to keep in mind that, if I may say it tongue-in-cheek to you guys, as ignorant as most of you are, your ignorance pales in comparison with the ignorance of most Jews 200 years ago and going back even further. I'm not going to discuss the question of Yerida Sadoros, Aliyah Sadoros, but the bottom line is the average Jew today is far better educated than the average Jew was 100 or 200 years ago, and certainly going back 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, at the time of the Mishnah, most people did not write. Most people couldn't write. It's not clear how many people could read. Literacy in this room certainly is 100%. I wouldn't always know that reading your exams, but basically it is 100%. And so they translated the Targum, and that was people's perhaps only source of instruction of Torah. Truth is, Torah Shebaal Peh was probably not written down. Certainly wasn't accessible back then. So the only access. The only sources people had for religious practice were either their parents, their homes. There were children who learned. There was some type of a system of Malamde Tinokos, but not clear how extensive it really was. And basically, the whatever exposure a person might have received in a Beis HaKnesses context, which would either consist of Kriyas HaTorah with the Targum, or you had, not necessarily in the context of Tefillah, but in the Beis HaKnesses, of the Drasha. And you have reference, the issue of, any you learn called Kisvei? that you were not allowed to be studying Suvim Shas HaDrasha because that was when the only time people could get halachic instruction. Because if you missed the drasha, you couldn't pick up a Mishnah Brura or Shulchan Aruch and go see what the halacha was. Okay. I'm sorry? I understood. Yes. You couldn't pick up a Gemara either. That's correct. So you see the liturgical function of the Targum being discussed in Maseches Megillah and the Mishnayos there. There are certain ways you're not supposed to translate, such as Misarachalo Sitain La Bir La Molech, Misarachalo Sitain La Abra Bir Amar Yusa. So you shut that person up strongly, the Mishnah says. Similarly, the Mishnah speaks about those passages that you're allowed to translate and those which you don't translate. Masa Ruvein, the Mishnah says, is read but not translated. Masa Tamar is read and translated. The Egel HaRishon is read and translated. The Sheni is read but not translated. Apparently, Rashi, I think, says, because it says, Vayetzeha Egel Hazeh, was a piskom pelaminim that the Egel came on its own. And various other things which you don't read after, and you can read after, and can you read the Merkava? We do, by the way, but the Mishnah says you don't. Rabbi Yehuda says you do. Rabbi Eliezer says you don't read Hodas Yushalayim as Tal Voseh, and we had this discussion already, I think, last week, that some traditions, most Chumashim have printed this Haftorah for Achrimos when Achrimos and Kiddushim are separate. The Rav was apparently very machbid after you just read the Haftorah of Kiddushim twice. You have to see which one. I think Halocha Mechushim Atemli is the one you're supposed to read. Not the one from Yecheskel, I think Parachat. Anyway, I once had the story, the Rav the Shul of my Shul told me, asked them which Haftorah, because it wasn't clear, he said, read the one for Kedoshim, and whatever, the Korin, or whatever it had it printed, it said, that's Yushalayim, so that's the one I read. Okay. Anyway, fine. So that's the major function, yes. Targum would be considered Tor Shel Pei. Yeah, there is a famous Tosefta in Shabbos about a Targum Shel Iyov, which Rabbi Gamliel HaZakein told them to be Meshakeh in the Binyan. Right?
So that means that why was that
going to
be written down?
It wasn't. Rabbi Gamliel told them to be gonies, the Targum.
So the Targum that we're talking about was oral?
Oral, absolutely, oral.
We're not talking about Targum, we're talking about
an oral version of it. Look, it's clear there are two things. It's clear that there's a semi-official Targum floating around in Babel by the 3rd century, because that was the Gemara Megillah, right? Targum Shel Torah speaks of a specific Targum. From the Gemara's in Kiddushin, on the other hand, it's clear that the Targumanim had a certain degree of flexibility. They probably had certain traditions of how you translated certain phrases or certain sukkim, or which things that you cited, you know, which midrashim you cited, but on the one hand. On the other hand, it's clear that there was a certain amount of make it up as you go along. I don't mean in the negative sense, but you translate on the fly, because the Gemara Kiddushin speaks about the guy who is, you know, too literal, or not literal enough, whatever it is. So it does sound as if that there was a degree of flexibility that Mithra Gemanim had. There's certain things you're supposed to do, or things that you're not allowed to do. What else might have the Targum been used for in theory, only at a written stage? It might have been used for study. Okay, if you you might use an English translation, somebody might use an Aramaic translation. Similarly, there is another halachic function for it. A halacha which is ignored by the many is a very, very important halacha. If everybody here did it, you would be much more knowledgeable individuals. It would only take a year to be a very knowledgeable individual compared to where you are now, which is Shemos. This is Dina de Shulchan Aruch, happens to be in Hilchos Shabbos, by chance. But a person is obligated to read the Parsha over twice and read the Targum once. Amazingly enough, the Mechaber says that you can use Rashi. Kind of interesting. If people did that, you would be far more knowledgeable Jews. Because if you did it regularly, so after a few years, you'd have been through the Torah a number of times, and you would be more knowledgeable. Okay. It might have been used also educationally, but we don't really know. There's no real evidence that clearly there were some of the same issues of writing came up in pedagogical context. The issue of writing Torah Shebichtav when you don't write an entire Torah, writing only a Megillah. So there, the Gemara in Gittin Daf Samach has a discussion as to whether or not one is permitted to write smaller portions for children. And in the same sense, perhaps Targum might have been written down in a similar context, but there's really no way of knowing. Targumic techniques, how do Meturgamanim work? So obviously, on one level, they translate. On the other hand, translation, I think a very good assignment would be to give you several psukim to translate into English without consulting an English translation on your own. You would discover that translation is not as easy as it seems. Now, it's often not incredibly difficult, but you discover that there are things you have to do as a translator that you don't have to do when you interpret. One very simple thing is frequently when you're translating from one language to another, especially if they're very different languages, is word order or idiom. How you phrase something in the English language. For example, if you were translating a word in Hebrew, Nimsa ochel she'ena shalom. I'll make up an expression, but you have similar types of things. Nimsa ochel she'ena shalom. How would you translate it to English? Nimsa? No, you wouldn't translate it. It literally means it is found. It's not how you would translate it. How would you translate it? No. Let me see if I give you, let me just think of an example offhand. Come with the Mishnah. I can't think of a context offhand to give you it. We would translate Nimsa as it turns out. Nimsa Zeochel Shem Shalom. I realize you may not be able to catch from that small part. But you can think of a lot of expressions where the idiom changes from Hebrew to English, let's say. Right? You know, when you say, some of it can be for the dangers of over-literalism. Hey-id al. How would you translate hey-id al literally? Hey-id? Al. Right. So you literally testified on, but clearly in English, okay, that's a case where it may just be simply choice translation, testified about. There are a lot of examples, verb order, right? Gracious bara Elohim. Right, you wouldn't say in the beginning created God. You would say in the beginning God created. The Hebrew word order typically a noun verb. Frequently the noun comes after the verb. So there are a lot of choices a translator has to make, just in terms of even a literal translation. But then he has to deal with all sorts of other issues. So one very common issue, I'll mention sort of five things here, and I don't have examples for all of these because in the past I've never really had time for. Today I think feel I have more time actually to get through what I want to get through, some of them have examples. But there are five things, and you'll find this in the readings, where the Targum does something beyond, not quoting Medrash, but in translation, makes certain kinds of choices in how he translates. The first one is anthropomorphism. There is a long Ramban in Parshas Vayigash, and it's a discussion of the Rambam. In Mor Nevuchim, the Rambam claims that Unklus deliberately is anti-anthropomorphic. Very frequently, references to God in Unklus, turn into the Shechina of God or the Word of God, something which distances God from the physical. Rambam claims that Unklus is doing that to avoid God having any corporeal aspects, any physical bodily aspects. That, of course, is no great shock, because the Rambam was an Aristotelian. Now, what was Unklus exactly doing? So the Ramban just points out that there are so many times that Unklus doesn't do it. So it's hard to know exactly why Unklus is doing what he's doing, but it's hard to claim that Unklus was an Aristotelian, basically. Now, the truth is that I suspect the Rambam is correct to some extent. There do appear to be a lot of cases where that seems to be the agenda of Unklus, but it's not entirely clear. But it's certainly not a programmatic agenda or systematic agenda. Yes. No, I don't mean that. That may explain certain cases, but while I'm saying that there are plenty of cases that God is referred to, not God speaking in the first person, not in vision, where God is speaking to him and doing something, which just doesn't bother with it. You can look at the Ramban. It's in Vayigash. I think it's on Vayizbach Tzvachim L'Elokeinu Aviv Yitzchak. It's around there. I think it's right before the names. Anthropomorphism. Anthropomorphic means giving human qualities. And we use this in this context, it means using human qualities given to God. God gets angry. God saw. Anthropomorphic. Anthropomorphic. Okay. You never heard of anthropomorphism? Where'd you go to high school? Don't answer that question. Okay. Fine. I didn't hear the response, but... Sorry? Okay. Fine. Actualization, which is updating places and names more to the contemporary scene. We had a long fight about this last week, David, about Fatima, right, the wife. Okay, we don't have to continue the fight. I was pointing out that's an example. Or when you'll get in, sometimes names are filled in of places that may not have existed in the biblical period, but they exist in the Talmudic period or in the Targumic period. Doublets. Sometimes you get double translations of a phrase or more phrase than a verse. This may be a product of more than one possibility. Sometimes you have two interpretations that the Targum wants to include. You will find this occasionally in Unklus on the poetical sections, where not only does he translate not literally, but he often quotes multiple interpretations of phrases. That he incorporates them both into a sentence. It also may be there are cases that a doublet preserves a textual variant. The Radak spoke about Kreyuk Siv as a way to preserve two readings of a text. Sometimes the Targum may preserve two readings of a text he has in front of him. The last two are what are called associative translation and complementary translation. Associative translation occurs that sometimes you have very similar phrases in two places in the Torah, and the Targum on one actually reflects the other pasuk. I mean, in both were Targum in both places reflects the reading of one pasuk. It's not what's that? I'm not sure what you're talking about. The only thing in the Gemara I can think of that corresponds to this is the principle of Yagid Alav Reo. It's quoted a few places in Shas. There's one on Ayin Vav and Aleph in. And this is not a good example for the Targum. In Hasugya of Hagolas Kelim. So, in one place, the Torah speaks about Umorat Shifapa Mayim. It doesn't talk about passing anything through the fire. In the Parsha of Kodshim. In the Parsha of Klei Midyan, it talks about Kol Davar Sheva Va'esh Tavir Va'esh V'Taher. The Kol Davar Sheva Va'esh Tavir V'Mayim. I skipped the line in between there. Don't worry, I know that. Afamini Da Yishatam. So, I should just not have bothered skipping it. So there you have both Eish and Mayim as a way of purifying Kalim. So what about Eish in the context of Kodshim? So there's a long discussion in that sugya there, but I think Abai is the one who says Yagid Alav Reo, that the Torah didn't mention it there, but the other place sheds light on that. And those are examples that are not verbally really identical. But had they been verbally identical, but one had been left out in one place, you might find a Targum that would quote both in both places. And basically he's in effect interpreting one text intentionally or not. Maybe he's got a mistake in his head as he translates. He's got an echo of the other pasuk in his head, and he translates one just like the other, even though in one place some of the details are missing. Okay, that would be a complementary translation. An associative translation would be if you had two similar things, not two things in one place in the other, and he were to translate the same way in both places, even though they're different. So that would be called an associative translation. Yes, Jeremy? Question. The first one, that's called an associative translation. The first one's called a complementary. You're completing it, you're adding to it from something else. If you look in the... What's that? The complementary is when you have the example I gave, like Hagalas Kalim, assuming it had been verbatim, you know, the same words, where one place is one place mentions Libun and Hagala, the only place, other place only mentions Hagala. So the Targum, you know, if the Torah said in one place you should do Libun or Hagala, and the other place it said you should do Hagala, the Targum might have translated in both places you should do Libun or Hagala. No. They're similar in that similar phrases in Psukim have an influence upon the Targum of the parallel location, even though the text is different. associative is when you substitute one for the other. In other words, complementary means you add on to what's not there. There's a lacuna in a sense, put that in quotes, in the text in one place, but the targum fills that in based upon the other. Associative means it's substituting one for the other. I wish I had examples handy, then it would be easier to see. Okay, but they're in the readings. Okay, so that's general, that's true for every metargim. What other targumim exist besides Unklus and what we call Sidur Jonathan and Yonas and Anach? What other targumim exist? The most famous targum that exists besides the standard is? What? Rashi is not a targum, it's not a translation. Not even a type B. What? I said a translation, not a mangling of the English language. Okay. What is yes, the Septuagint, the Targum HaShivim. The Septuagint, what is the origin of the Septuagint? So let's take a look. Whip out your handy reader. And if you look in the Septuagint, the origin of the Septuagint, let us see. Source number 41. Did I talk about here Rashi in Greek? And Bereishis Bara Elokim in the word order? No. Ayol, did I talk about that in Shir? Bereishis Bara Elokim in the word order? Sound familiar? Okay, I don't know. Maybe it wasn't here. Okay. What does the Gemara say in Megillah? Who would like to read? Could Daniel go ahead? Mm-hmm.
Tanya Maisa, the Talmai Melech, is Maisa Talmai Melech, Shatina Shibim, Mishnayim, Zekinim, Yibarad, and Tamei.
You don't have to translate unless it's difficult. Zech Nisan.
Nisan, Mishibim, Mishnayim, Bashim, but like Yibu Lahem, Almach, Kinasan, Vinef, Hazetel, Balafim, Afim, Ramal, and Kisbu, Taras, Maisha, Rav, Kham, and Asa, Kadish, Barak, Lez, Malafim, and Afim, Eitz, of the scheme of Kulan, Adan, Ahas, the Kisbu, Lahem, and Kim, Barak, Barak.
Okay, then they list a bunch of changes they all made, even though they were put in separate rooms, and you didn't tell them why they were going there. So they couldn't consult before. I don't know if I said this here before. A friend of mine's joke, which is, this is not a miracle. The miracle would be if you put them in the same room, they came up with the same translation or the same changes. So, and then it goes on to list things that they changed. Now, some of these do not, I don't know how many of them actually appear in our Septuagint. And there are various reasons given for it. One comment about the first one, Elokim Bara Bereishis, Rashi explained, Rashi suggests or interprets that Shalayomar Bereishis Shemu Ushtei Rishuyos Hein Verishon Baras Hasheni, that somebody created God. Somebody named Bereishis created God. It's a nice interpretation Rashi gives, but unfortunately, because Rashi had no contact with Greek and he didn't know Greek, had he known Greek, he would not have written this, because if you know anything about Greek, it's impossible for this to have happened. It's impossible for it to have happened because in English we don't have such a thing. Something called cases. A noun is marked for how it's used in a sentence, meaning a noun when it's a subject is different than a noun when it's the object of a verb. In English, you only see this in the pronouns, right? How do you see this? He and him, right? You don't say him went to the store. You use he when it's the subject, when it's what we call nominative. You use him when it's the object of a preposition or a direct object of the verb. And when you want to use possessive, when you want to say of he, you say his. Okay, you don't have to know these terms. It's called genitive. Anybody here ever done German? Any doing German? Latin. I don't know how. What, Latin? Okay, so you know the cases from Latin. The Greek is the same thing. One person, okay, doing Latin, doing or done Latin. Now that what that means is, it's for that reason that German is such a vicious language, because German also has cases, and you can basically, when you have cases, what does that cases allow you to do, Jeremy? Yes, and therefore, what flexibility do you have that you don't have in English?
Word order.
You can put it. You can put the object, direct object, first, and then you can put the verb, and then you can put the subject, because it doesn't matter where you put them. You know how they're marked. Because of that, in Greek, the word for God in Greek is theos. You probably recognize that from theological. Ha theos is God, or the God, literally, but it's. Ha-theos, if it were the object of a verb, it would be ton-theon. It would be a different ending. It would be an N ending rather than a sigma, an S ending. Okay, so therefore, even if you had written Bereshis Bara Elokim, Elokim, the trans for the translator, still would have been in the nominative form. It would have been a subject form, and therefore you could not have made the mistake. So that's probably not why they rearranged the order according to the passage. Probably because they wanted God's name to appear first. Okay, fine. This, by the way, is a general concern. It should not, chas v'shalom, be taken as to make light of Rashi. But if you're not aware of a particular reality, so then this is simply you're forced to interpret in the same way that we've seen that the Rishonim, in the absence of having what I would call the original biblical Hebrew dictionary or the archaeology, so they're forced to guess at certain words which may come to light in light of archaeology. This is no different. And those of you, almost all of you learning Shabbos, if you look at Rashi's comments about day trees and Ayin Gimel Lamed Beis, the Mfarek Tmarim, Haiman Desha the Pisa Levikla. I don't know, this might or might not have caused Rashi to say what he said. In all probability, in almost certainty, Rashi never saw a day tree in his life. Probably none of you have either. Have seen a day tree. You might have seen, but actually look carefully to see how the fruits grow. You might have, but Rashi certainly didn't. And so Rashi therefore has to sort of only envision, based upon what he sees in the Gemara, and there are a limited number of Gemaras, what exactly a date palm looks like. Yeah, sure. I'm sorry? Well, the question, you have to look there. It could be that's not what's causing him to interpret the way he does in Shabbos. I have to take a look there. Where in? Okay, but you have to look at Rashi's description. You know what a day tree looks like? Right. So you have to look and see whether Rashi's description really fits. If it doesn't, it shouldn't surprise you, and if not, it shouldn't cast light on. You know, it shouldn't make light of Rashi. It's just that, you know, if you know what a pomegranate tree looks like. Okay, I don't know what a pomegranate tree looks like. Any trees you don't know what they look like? Okay. What's that? It's a bush. What's that? Well, that's correct, but they would have to be able to see a day tree. Problem is, day trees don't grow in France. That's the problem. So, in other words, it has to be. People couldn't travel, and people couldn't take pictures. I mean, you could have had a drawing, but basically, in the ancient world, where you know Ashkenazi Rishonim lived in certain periods, so they would not have been able to see certain kinds of vegetation. That can be seen now. If you leave a little bit of warmer climate, you can take advantage of pictures. And the same thing is true of languages. Okay, it's not a new issue. Fine. Now, what is the problem with the Targum HaShem? Yes, Ayo? Well, you have to stop for 1 second. In this context, and we've addressed this a little bit already, you have to first see whether these changes, in fact, are in the text. In other words, these changes are obviously not in the Masoretic text, nor I think most of these changes appear in our text of the Septuagint. So it's not clear what exactly the point of this particular tradition is. There is a very fairly similar tradition found. The first place this story is found about the Targum HaShulchan, you know where that is? The letter of Aristeus. It's, I think, part of the pseudepigrapha. I don't think it's the apocrypha. But if you go to the collection of pseudepigrapha, you can read about it. And it's the earliest source for this origin of the Septuagint. A very, very similar story. This story is also found in a couple of other places in Chazal, a couple of times in Maseches Sofrim, and I think there's one other occurrence. How does the... So going back to your comment... it's not entirely, I don't know where these changes come from. I don't remember if any of them are in the Septuagint, but certainly, I know the first one is not. Elokim Bara Bereshis is not the case. So, but let's talk about cases. I was about to ask a question, which you were really anticipating. What is the problem with our Septuagint? Problem. We regard it as a problem, not everybody does. What was the problem that always confronted scholars with the Septuagint? Is that frequently, if you were to reverse translate the Greek, you would wind up with a text different than the Hebrew text. This is not a new problem. This is a very old problem. This problem was noticed in the first or second century.
Why is that a problem?
Well, did they have a different Hebrew text?
It's meant to be translated from Hebrew to Greek, not from Hebrew to Hebrew.
Yeah, but you expect it to be the same text.
Don't we know it's not flying?
You translated the exact importance. It should be more different.
No. No one's talking about subtle use of idiom here. We're talking about, you know, I mean, I'll give you the example, but this could be exegesis, not different text. V'lo yishmerenu be'olav, and the Septuagint says, and the owners don't destroy it. Now, when you see a reading like that, what's the first thing you think about, if you're willing to envision the possibility? Yeah? I said that already, that there's clearly a connection, but... that's the working list. What happened? It's possible it's interpretation, it's not a possibility.
I'll give you a little hint here.
Okay, what happened here?
Dolly was arranged.
I forgot the number, sorry. Either
way.
Yishmerenu and Yishmerenu can easily be either another text or can be just misread by the translator.
That tells your doctor.
I said, what's that? Okay. Well, here's the way. If you want to preserve your frumkai, you have to decide whether you want to dismiss the agada or you want to dismiss the pasuk. So you could say it's an agada. The translation came about by some people working together. I'm just saying. Alternatively, you'll say they had a different text in front of them. Now, it could be interpretational, but there are many cases where it doesn't work that way. There are books enough, and that translation is not as early, where it's the whole half the books in different order. Yirmiyahu particularly stands out in that respect. So the question is, what do you do with this? With these translations, the Septuagint appears not to have the Hebrew text. Well, the answer is severalfold. Sometimes it's interpretation. Sometimes it's an error of the translators. Sometimes they had a different Hebrew text. If we weren't sure that there was sometimes a different Hebrew text, Qumran has proven it beyond a shadow of a doubt. Okay, there are many readings that the Septuagint preserves that are found in some of the texts at Qumran, some Hebrew texts at Qumran. So whatever exactly these scrolls were, and I, you know, and just don't tell me that Qumran was the Geniza, okay? But whatever the Qumran was, somebody's library. Whose library, we don't know. What's that? How do we know it's not a Geniza? You have to work the other way. Why would you assume so? There are plenty of non-holy. There are non-holy texts in there. There are multiple copies. It appears to have been a library. The stuff was on shelves originally. A lot of the damage that occurred to some of the scrolls were when the jars fell off the shelves and there was water on the floor of the cave. But they were originally, put in jars in caves, not Geniza. What's that? Not necessarily, but Geniza material wasn't taken care of that well. The Cairo Geniza wasn't in the ground. I mean, well, it was just stored away in some room. That's 1,000 years later. But I'm just, as far as we know, I don't know if they actually, their sense of Geniza, the one sense I have of Geniza is when they put it in a building, like where we would do it, in a sense, bury it in the ground or something like that, the Fezeftin Shabbos. But that's not what happened in Qumran. There are also plenty of good Masoretic texts there. That most of the texts are more like the Masoretic texts than like other texts. So what do you do with those? Right? So what do you do with the translation? The answer is they sometimes had a different Hebrew text. Now, yes, Ephraim.
You see, we have a protected Hebrew and the translation is...
Seems to reflect... Right. It seems... So one solution, it's not the only one in this case. This is a case where it could have been interpretation. It could have also been an error, a misreading, But here's a case where you could imagine easily how someone could have a text for Lo Yishmedenu Ba'alav, and then the translation makes sense. The answer is yes, but we're not even evaluating that issue. All I'm saying is, whose text was correct? Well, we follow Masoretic text, right? The fact is they had a different text in front of them. To you, the idea that somebody had a different text may not be so radical. You simply dismiss it as not a legitimate one or not the correct version. Once upon a time, that was difficult for people to swallow, especially in light of the fact that the Septuagint is, at least according to the Haggadah, is described as this great, great occurrence. Now, Maseches Sofrim, by the way, does not regard it so highly. It regards it as one of the bad days in history for the Jewish people. One of the traditions has it associated with Asar B'Tevet. If you look at Maseches Sofrim, there are two passages here. Turn to the next page, 42. Well, because the Gemara seems to give its imprimatur to it.
Well, no, I'm not saying there wasn't a Septuagint. How do we know the Septuagint we have exactly?
Fine. No, but the fact is, why would they deliberately? Let's accept.
I don't know. Perhaps the church scraps looking through it. Maybe.
Well, I'll have a comment that you'll see why that's not true in a second. If you want it, you can construct the following very firm argument. That's fine. I don't really have a vested interest. Which is that there was original Septuagint. It's not the one we have. Okay. But our Septuagint is a different translation. Okay, so it doesn't have Chazal's imprimatur, and therefore you don't have to worry about what Hebrew text it had. You have to acknowledge it had a different Hebrew text. Now, to say that they deliberately did so, I think is unlikely, and it's something I'm about to tell you after we do the Maseches Sofrim about the revisions of the Greek translation. I'll talk about that in a moment. If you look in the Maseches Sofrim Halacha Zayin, Masa Behezek Kenim Shekasu L'Talmai HaMelech HaSatori Yevonis V'Hayo HaYom Kashu L'Yisrael Kiyom Shenasa Egel Shelohai Satori Yechol Yitargin Kol Tzorcha. That it could not be properly translated. Translation never fully captures the meaning of what you're doing, and therefore it was a terrible day for the Jewish people. Okay, Shema Sebetalmei HaMelech. Okay, and this is basically the tradition that you find in the Bavli. So it's unclear how they regard the second one, but the truth is, this Maseches Sofrim seems not to regard the translation enterprise as such a positive thing. But yeah, you could, based on this Maseches Sofrim, even say the first one is the one we have, the second one is the one Chazal was referring to, but it doesn't exist anymore. Okay. However, modern scholars were not the first ones to have noticed that the Greek translation does not always conform to the Hebrew text. It was noticed already in the first and second centuries. And as a result, there were revisions of the retranslations of the Torah into Greek with the intent of making it conform more to the Hebrew text. And these really look like the Masoretic text, or very close to the Masoretic text, or much closer. There were three revisions. They were done by Akila, and we've spoken about that already. That's clearly the Yerushalmi's Akila Sager, Theodotion, and Symmachus. There was a version called the Hexapla, which is found, you can find it in the library. It was put out in the middle of the 3rd century by Origen, who I believe is one of the church fathers. And it contains 6 columns, hence the term Hexapla. Hexapla. What's that? Aquila, Theodotion, and Symmachus. And it contained the original the Hebrew, the original Septuagint, the three revisions, and I forget what the 6th column was. It might have been a transliteration. I'm not sure. I haven't looked at this in a very long time. But you can go to the library, they have a copy of the Hexapla, yeah. Akilas, you know. Yeah. Sumchus, you know. Symmachus. And you have to know Theodotion, God's gift. Okay. The Septuagint is a type A targum. You can reconstruct the text from it. It's fairly literal, but it uses good Greek, fairly decent Greek idiom. If it didn't, you would botch the language. The halacha of the Septuagint is interesting. Dr. Belkin, Zichrono Livracha, the past president of Yeshiva, wrote a good deal about the halacha of the Septuagint. he suspects that its halachic traditions reflect that of Alexandrian Jewry, not necessarily that of Eretz Yisrael Jewry. There certainly are some real differences in halachic interpretation. That in itself isn't surprising. You have variance within a degree of variance within Chazal. We've seen Targum Pseudo-Jonathan has a lot of very funny halachic shitos. One to add to your list that I was discussing with Professor Bernstein recently is who can sprinkle the waters of the Parah Aduma? Not who does the cow itself, but who does the sprinkling of the water. Chazal in the Bavli, Rav and Shmuel and Yoma, and the Sifrei are explicit that once you get to the Asifa, it's Rasaf Ish Tahar, it's no longer a Kohen. If you look at Qumran, however, and you look in Targum Pseudo-Jonathan, the Hizah HaTahar HaTameh HaTahar is a Kohen. Has to be a Kohen. To add more, add one more to the sort of a Chitzoni Oshitas that you find in Targum Pseudo-Jonathan, known from Qumran, disagrees with what, everything else we know from Chazal. So to find differences in the Septuagint is not surprising. One example I like to cite is a very interesting interpretation. The Torah speaks about a man, two men fighting, striking a pregnant woman, and distinguishes between two cases. The lo yason, the imason, yeah. What's the difference between the two? What's that? No, what's the mitzias? What does it mean, the lo yason? What does the lo yason mean? There's no miscarriage? No. Whether or not you kill the woman. The yatsu yilada, there's a miscarriage. The lo yason, but the woman isn't killed. So Chazal distinguish between when you kill the woman and don't kill the woman. In the Septuagint, the distinction is drawn between whether the fetus is fully formed or not. The lo yason means the fetus wasn't fully formed and therefore they're not liable for the death penalty. If, however, the fetus was fully formed, then you're chayav misa. Now that within Chazal, clearly Chazal do not read that way. The assumption of Chazal, certainly for a Jew, is that any time you kill a fetus, you're not chayav misa basin. Someone has suggested, I'm not... What's that? No, I don't think we say legabe mitzicha unless the child appears to be a preemie. I don't think we say you're part of our misa for that. There's a din of legabe avelus halacha de'avel. I don't know if we would say by pikuach nefesh that you machmir in that case to say that since the suffering, I'm not really sure. No, clearly you're not allowed to. The question is, Chayimisa, if you did within 30 days, yeah, that's his question. I don't remember if that issue is explicitly discussed in the Gemara. Anyway, so you have clearly a very different halakhic interpretation here. Okay, so it's not the first one. Other versions, other well-known translations of the Torah, the Vulgate was done by St. Jerome. The Vulgate is a translation into... You should know this, Jeremy? Latin. I don't know if you've read any of it yet, but... what's that? Ah, okay. Still a good thing. If you want to learn it again, you should have a Seder in that. I remember there was a person who used to be the principal here. I think it was... you know Rabbi Finkelstein? And you remember him? Nice. Too long before your time. He was principal in Florida at the time also. Anybody from Florida? No Florida? Okay, but anyway, so I remember his father-in-law, who used to be a scholar here, Professor Honig, I think, used to every year, I think he used to take another one of the Targum, he used to learn language that way. Because if you know the Hebrew, then you can go learn the other languages. I strongly recommend, by the way, it may not be an option for some of you, but I told this to my Talmidim and Shir, but it certainly is a matter of principle. There's a course being offered in Targumim next semester. I highly recommend you learn Aramaic. That is a way to do so. Of course, it's a Thursday Bible, so it has to fit with your Shir schedule as well. Anyway, so, I'm sorry? Yeah. Professor Bernstein. It's against my principles to recommend, I said this to my Shir also, a specific professor. It's not a recommendation about the professor over another professor. If somebody else were giving Targumim, I wouldn't say a word. But since Aramaic is often one of the greatest deficiencies of yeshiva students, second after Hebrew, so that is an opportunity. That's a great opportunity to actually learn some Aramaic and do some Targum. Again, given next semester? Okay, so that's an alternative. If you're not interested in Targum, then you should take Aramaic that way. I wasn't aware of that, but when I was in college, I took that course, and it was very, very worthwhile. So anyway, but yes, if you're not interested in Targum for whatever reason, but then I highly recommend you take Professor White's Aramaic course. Okay. I won't argue with that. What else is there besides the Vulgate? Syriac. Syriac, what is Syriac? It is an Aramaic, a dialect of Aramaic. And you can find, it has its own script. I can't read it, but it has its own script. It's, the Syriac scribes are actually amazing. I have a copy of the Syriac. Anyone know what it's called, by the way? What the Syriac translation is called? It's called the Peshitta. It is a fairly literal translation. You look at some of this. I have a printed edition of the Peshitta, of which a good part of the work apparently was actually not printed by a machine, but actually a photo offset of handwritten text. And looking at it, you would not be able to tell the difference. It's incredible. Anyway, you wouldn't recognize the script, but it would look like it was done by a machine, not by a human hand. It's a dialect of Aramaic. So you will see, in the time that we have to look at the Targumim today, we will read some of the Peshitta, but it's been transliterated. It's been transcribed from those Hebrew those characters. It's the same. It's one to one. There's an aleph in the Syriac script. There's a beis. There's a gimel. There's a dalet. It corresponds one to one. They just in some of the printed editions, printed versions of the Peshitta, they have now placed it in Hebrew characters. The standard Ksav Ashuri, I should say. Okay. Syriac is probably 3rd to 4th century of the Common Era. Originally in the Hebrew script, later in what's called the Jacobite script. I don't know if we don't know, we're not so clear on its origins exactly. Is it Jewish?
Yes.
I don't know. I think it is, but I'm not sure. If you look in the Encyclopedia Judaic article, he probably talks about it, gives you a little bit of background on the Peshitta. Okay, now one or two other Targum. I mentioned the fragment, the Pseudo-Jonathan and Targum Yerushalmi, the fragment Targum, that they're both really Yerushalmis. There's one other Targum to be aware of, which we're going to look at now also, is Neofiti. Neofiti is an Eretz Yisrael Targum. You know what Neofiti means? Neofiti, I believe, is a ger. It means a neophyte. I don't remember exactly where it got its name from. I used to know. Be it as it may, it's called Targum Neofiti, and it is basically a whole Targum. It's a fairly literal Targum, but it does have, it's more expansive than Unklus, it's less expansive than Pseudo-Jonathan. That's the best way we can say it. Okay. Now, if you turn to page 37 in the reader, let's take a look at a little bit of Unklus Aramaic. Who would like to read? Ephraim, do you want to read? Are you so brave as to want to read? Okay. Yeah, going backwards. All right, now there are two problems with reading the Nekudos here. Number one, you don't recognize them. Number two, even if you did, it's a little hard to see. The double dots on top sometimes look like a straight line. So, for example, on the first line, the straight line is a shva or chatapata. In this case, it's a shva. The second one is two dots. The tere. Tere looks like a tere. It's just on top of it. As is the chirek. Okay. The ilain. Dinaya. That's a patach and a kamas. There, the two differences. Ditasdar. You might start to look at what looks kind of like an ayin that got bent over on its side a little bit. Push down, that's the patach. Dithasdar kodomehon, okay? What does that mean? That's ve'ela mishpatim asher tosim. Tosim is interpreted as to place or to order, perhaps. It's not clear to me tasdar means anything more than to place before, but okay. Fine, continue. Yeah. Now, there is already a piece of translation here. It's not really translation, it's obvious, which is?
Ivri.
What does Ebed Ivri mean? There are two possibilities. It is syntactically ambiguous. Like, such fancy words?
Omer is Jewish.
Okay, it means Ivri is either an adjective or it's a noun. It's either the Evet of an Ivri or an Evet Ivri. So he interprets which way? An Evet Shel Ivri or an Evet Ivri?
An Evet Ivri.
An Evet Ivri, right? An Avda Bar Yisrael. See, so there's a case, by the way, a perfect example where something in the Hebrew is syntactically ambiguous, but when you translate, you must make a choice. But if you, especially if you were translating in Aramaic, you might be able to get away with it. If you translate into English, do you have a choice? No. The same ambiguity does not exist in English. So you either have to translate if you buy a Jewish servant or if you buy the servant of a Jew. So that's where translation forces you to interpret, not just translate.
Well, the part is that translation, like the Gemara, the ambiguity is that it's done on purpose or it's done.
Correct. So sometimes ambiguity may be deliberate, sometimes it's not. That you don't have that liberty, that's correct.
That
Shalo Hisayef Atar Yechol Ali Targin Kol Tarka. That can be one interpretation of it. You lose the sense that the original Hebrew carried. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you 100%. A translation always loses. There's nothing like reading something in the original. It's the way it is. You have to just decide whether you have the ability, the willingness to labor and the intelligence and the time to invest so that you can read something in its original. I remember there aren't too many people who know Ethiopic. But if you want to study the Book of Jubilees seriously, you have to learn it. Professor Bernstein told me his father. Does the name Zeitlin mean anything to any of you? Yes. Professor Zeitlin from Dropsy College, which no longer exists in Philadelphia. Is anybody from Philly here? Nobody from Philly? I thought it was from Philly. There used to be a Jewish, college. What's that? Okay, which is now no longer a university, but it is. There's an institute, the Annenberg Institute for Advanced Jewish Studies. So Zeitlin was a professor there for a long time. So Zeitlin was basically off the walls. I mean, his theories are nutty to say the least. So anyways, Professor Bernstein told me his father at one point was so irritated with Zeitlin's theories. His father was a Rosh Yeshiva here and then taught in Revel. So irritated with Zeitlin's theory that he learned Ethiopic just so he could argue on him. But when you want to do something seriously, you have to learn the original language. It's the only way to do it. Okay. You want to learn Gemara? Art Scroll lead the way. Okay. Professor White's army, of course, is the way. Okay, go ahead. Yiflach. Okay, my students in Shir know this is one of my favorite examples of a false friend. In Ayin Beis Dalet in Aramaic means what? What's that? Absolutely not. This is the word to work. Plach. What's that? It means to do. The Hebrew asa is always translated as Ayin Beis Dalet. Ayin Beis Dalet in Hebrew is translated as plach. Like Avodah Zarah is pulchan anuchra. Okay? It's easy to mistake that. But here, this you can't make the mistake on. Okay, go ahead. That's correct. Yipoke, what's the root? Nun pe kuf, as in nafka mina, nafak, nifak. Magan. What does magan mean? For nothing. Asya, the aseb, magana, shavi magana. Doctor who heals for nothing is worth nothing. Apparently, they never saw the American healthcare crisis. Okay. Go ahead, next. What's the Yeol? My favorite. To come in, it's Ayin Lamid. Lamid, do not confuse this with Hebrew Allah. Okay. Alright, so what is he translating here? Bigapo. What does Bigapo mean? Well, some of you said, the truth is, it's very interesting. Is guf a biblical Hebrew word? Guf, not gapo. You're assuming that's what gapo means. The word guf with the vav there appears only once or one pasuk in Tanakh. In Divrei Hayamim, they talk about gufasha all the gufos manav. It's the only place. It's possible. Gapo is related to guf. It's certainly possible, but this word I don't believe appears anywhere else, so it's uncertain. But the context is clearly is clear. In Bigapo Yavo Bigapo Yete, but in Bali Shahu. Okay, go ahead. In Be'el Ititahu. T-poke. Okay, you know what an itita is? A woman. Okay, fine. Continue. You'll do three and the pasuk vav. Benin or benan? Do you recognize those words? We talk about Aramaic has a funny expression here. We talk about benin dichrin and benan nukvan. If you learn the Mishnayos and Ksubas about the Tanoi Ksuba, the male sons and the female sons, or it might be the male sons and the female daughters, depending on how you want to translate. But benin are banim and benan are banos. Okay, that's just the Aramaic.
What was the word that after him? Was that
Rabtei
or
a Rabtei? It's a vav nun. It's not. The printing is terrible. I know in the future, when I get to redo this reader, I'll find that it has not shrink the print down. I'm trying to think how large. I mean, I have actually. This, by the way, this targum was done by Professor Sperber, Alexander Sperber, not Daniel Sperber, the one who's written the book Simon Hagi Yisrael. Anyway, on the bottom you have variants from other manuscripts of Unklus. Remember, Unklus was a very commonly copied thing, especially in Tayman, but even elsewhere, because Unklus was used in Tayman up until recently. Did Taymanim still use the Targum? I think they do. So they preserved it. And I mentioned already last week, it was even at one point there was a Masora, there's a Masora on Unklus. Okay. So what happens? Itita uvenaha. Liribona. Vilchodohi. Okay, this is the only, so again, these are only two times the word, these two psukim, the gapo.
But the two vertical dots, what is that?
It's a cholam. Vilchodohi. Okay. So how does he translate Amor Yomar Ha'eved? Literally, Meimar Yemar. Meimar in Aramaic, Lememar, is the infinitive. And that's what Amor is. Right? There are two kinds of infinitives. One is an infinitive when you just say, to do something, Lishmor, and then Shamor Tishmarun, is a different kind of infinitive. It's used in conjunction with a finite verb for emphasis. Well, how do you normally translate that in English? In Shamor Tishmarun? You will surely listen. Okay, it's some type of emphasis implied in that. One of them, I think, I never get them straight. One of them is called the infinitive absolute, and one of them is called the infinitive construct. So here he translates just literally. He doesn't do anything with the double language. Not surprising. It's Unklus. Meimar Yemar Abda. Go ahead. Rachimna. Rachimna, I should say. Rachimna. What does Rachimna mean?
Okay, I'm just getting my chance to do our Aramaic. Probably
won't be going to take one of the Aramaic courses next month, sir. Probably. Okay, firstly, you'll see this all over the Gemara. You should learn to translate, to recognize the difference between present tense and past tense. This is Rachim, alright? It should be Rachim. Rachimna should be Kaseh, right? It's Kaseh, yeah. It means it's a contraction. I am Rachem. What does Resh Ches Mem mean in Aramaic? It means beloved. It's not the Resh Ches Mem of Hebrew, which may or may not be related, which is to have mercy upon. Where do you find Resh Ches Mem in Hebrew that probably is related to the root of love? You'll pardon me for saying this, but Rechem. Most probably. think about it. Okay. So, and there are, by the way, some usages in biblical Hebrew that would suggest also that that rachem sometimes may mean more to love than in the Aramaic usage than to have mercy upon. Okay.
Does that make sense that it all comes together then?
The roots, the words may be related. I said that from the start. They may be, but it's not clearly. Okay. Continue. I love my master. Yes.
Yes.
Right. Benai. I love my afi es adoni es ishti ve es benai. Okay, law is Aramaic now. Law ipok bar chorin. I do not want to go free. Okay, so far we haven't had, we've had eved ifri, we've had bigapo. Continue. Vi karvine. Dayonaya. Okay, here you go. What do we have here? 1 second, before you go on, what we already have a piece of interpretation here. Elohim, okay. Vi yisho Adonav el ha Elohim, okay. Then vi karvine. You read the next one. Next one. Vi karvine. Levat or levat. Probably dasha. What dasha? A door, right? If you're learning subas, anybody here learning subas? No, you're all newbies, right? On campus, you didn't do Ksubas 2 years ago. Derech Sham is the folk etymology given by the Gemara Ksubas. That's a folk etymology, not a linguistic one. But it's a door. Okay? Derech Sham. But that's a good way to remember it. That's what a folk etymology is, in effect. Okay? So you should take him. Higisho El Hadeles. So far, so good. Oh. Dilvat. Mizuzta. So can you tell me, what is Dilvat? O dilavas mizusta. No, it's not. What? Oh, okay. Before you get that far, just translate. You see, I would expect them to say, O levat mizusta. What is dilavat mizusta? It means that which is near the mezuzah. That's what the dala does.
So what?
Anyone want to fill in the so what? The so what here is that the Mechilta says that it's not, you don't actually rotsea in the mezuzah. And they have a whole drasha about it. And Unklis, it appears, with one letter, has managed to incorporate the interpretation of the Mechilta. Okay? Had Unklis wanted to translate literally, he would not have put that dollar there, and you would have thought that it meant that you are, what is to be rotsea? To pierce. To pierce his ear on the doorpost. You don't. You pierce it on something that's next to the doorpost. Okay? So, and that's what Unklis is incorporating with that Dalet. Not O Levat Mizusta, a Dilavat Mizusta. That which is next to the Mizusta. Okay? And then what happens?
Odnei,
yeah, Odnei. What's Odnei? Dalet and Zion. Yeah, magic. And you start to do enough Targum with the Hebrew, you start to get good in Aramaic. If anybody, actually, by the way, listens to me in my harangues about learning Aramaic and doing Targum, come back to me a year or two from now and tell me that you didn't, okay? Give me a little nachas. Okay? You have to at least a little nachas to go along with the Agmas Nefesh. Go ahead. Okay, with the Marzea. Okay. Now, what's going on? There's an extra word in here, right? Avad palach le'olam. Palach is like kasev. It's a participle. If he will be for him a servant, what is palach le'olam? Works forever. What is an eved olam? An eternal servant? No. It doesn't mean anything. That's why he interprets palach le'olam. He's not really adding, you know, an expansion. He's just giving meaning to the words. Be aware, by the way, just for your knowledge of Hebrew and Aramaic, the word olam is what in Hebrew?
A young boy.
What?
A young boy.
It's No. Olam. What is the equivalent in Hebrew? Somebody said it. Olam. This is what's known, this shift from Cholam to Kamas, I forget which way we call it, is known as the Canaanite shift. It's very common. It's why Tov in Hebrew is Tava in Aramaic. All over the place. Okay? You'll be aware of it. It just helps you realize in pronunciation certain things. For example, those who know what a Kamas Katon is, or bother to pronounce it, you will realize La'olam or La'olamei Olamaya is not a Kamas Katon, the Ayin. Because that kamas, it looks like it, olmaya, right? That would make perfect sense. It's wrong. It's olmaya. It's a kamas gadol. Why? Because you know that that's the equivalent of the Hebrew cholam, just translated into Hebrew, right? And you get olam. And the cholam in Hebrew is the kamas gadol in Aramaic. Not in everything, but I mean when you have this shift. When you find a kamas in Aramaic that happens to be a cholam in Hebrew, that's a Canaanite shift, and that means the kamas is long. Okay, so be aware of it. Who would like to take over? Very nicely read. Ezra, you're cruising. Go ahead. I have to admit, with having to read, when I read this still, I don't do enough of it. I have read sections with the Nikud, but because I know Aramaic reasonably well already, it's easier for me to read with the Nikud. If you're not as comfortable in Aramaic, it's harder to read with the Nikud until you really get comfortable knowing it. So it would be easier if you had the Nikudas on the bottom with the Tiberian vocalization. Go ahead. No, with a capital N and a capital O, not Yizban. Yaz, I'm more concerned with the Patach at the front. Yazbein as opposed to Yizbein, if there is a word. What is Yizbein? No, that's Yazbein, that's a Hithiel. It's one of those tricky words in Aramaic. Zavan. No one makes that sense. Dizban is a funny word in Chad Gadya. The Zabain is to sell. Zvan is to buy. Okay? In Hebrew, it's... No, it doesn't depend upon context. Trying to figure out what the vocalization is depends upon context. To know whether it's a kal, or pa'al, what we call a pa'al in Aramaic, or an afel. The way you make, by the way, a cause in Hebrew... How do you make a causative in Hebrew? If machar were the kal and you wanted to make a hifil out of a causative, how do you say it? You make a hifil. You do him kir. There's no such word. There is a hit machar, but it means something else. But Hebrew happens to be machar and kana. But if you want to lavash means he put on. How do you say he dressed somebody else? He caused to get dressed. Hilbish. In Aramaic, it's the ta'al, which is like pa'al in Hebrew, and af'el. So zvan is pa'al. I'm wrong here. Here it's not the Hifil, it's a pile. It's like Hebrew PL, Zabain. I got that wrong. I need a better Apek. Okay. Nifak is he went out. Anpek, which becomes Apek or Apek, means he took out. Let's see. Okay, then disappears. That's Pa'al and Afel. Here it's Pa'al and Pa'el. All right, I'm gonna give you a 5-minute Aramaic grammar for those who know Hebrew. You'll get the lesson here. Okay, the first time. There are three binyanim in Aramaic generally. You've done most of the Hebrew. Done Hebrew? Mostly, okay. Well, I'm going to translate for you before you. Ka'al. Maybe you don't know the language of the Ayin normally, but. Okay. Ka'al. And. Okay. These are the three binyanim in Aramaic. Ka'al is like Hebrew Ka'al, Pa'al. Pa'el, so the Dagish Hasmonos like Hebrew Pio. Afel is like Hebrew Hithiel. If you want to make passive verse, you know how you do it? It's really convenient. Stick an is in front. Sometimes the tuff gets lost, which is a little nasty and you get a duggish. But basically, that's Aramaic grammar for you. It doesn't tell you how to conjugate all the forms. That's the basic rule. So Zabain is a pa'el, Zivan is the cow, or the cow. The question? I'll take questions.
I'll
Pa'al and Afel. Those are the binyanim. Yes.
So, which one is this? Zabain is to...
Zabain is to sell. Okay. Zivan is to buy. And just remember, Zivan Abba Bistrei Zuse. He bought, right? He bought him a goat.
Okay, so,
Arayyan.
Dizvan. Probably it's you're making the design of Shmanach because the chirik under the dalet Dizvan. Yeah. To sell Zvan. No, and then yes, and Zvan is to buy. Yeah. I don't think so. I could get it all backwards, but I'm pretty sure not. No, I think there was somebody hyper correcting. Zvan is to buy. Yeah, that's always new at print. Zvan Abba Bizvish. Anyway, okay, well, one second, and I mispronounced this word, that's why. The answer is yes, I stand by that. The word, the first vowel is probably shva, yizabain. Okay? There's a patach above the zayin. Look at the bar, two lines above, and the next word, givar, that's the patach. So if you have a patach under the zayin, that tells you immediately. It's not yizvan, it's yizabain, and it's a tzera on the base. They don't put a dagesh in, just a vowel. So the answer is, now I will stand behind it, is this on Abba Bisrei. Okay. So, it's very nasty, but that, what's that? Okay, that's okay. Go ahead. Hare yizabain.
Hare yizabain.
Givar.
Givar. Givar. Yasparte.
Birate. He sells his daughter. La'amhu, that's the straight line above this. Shura, go ahead. La. Ti, poke. Now you have to be consistent. Kimas konat. Good. Okay, lo seitei, kitei saladim. What does that mean? Targum doesn't tell you, he translates literally. Okay, he avoids it most of the time. Go ahead. What does bishat mean? Yeah, bish is ra imra'a. Okay. Bish and bishat. Be'enei.
That line is the shva.
The patach is like the ayin. The scrunched ayin. The tilted ayin on top. Rebone your detastroyan. Rebone da.
Rebone da.
Dikaima lay. So imra abeine adoneha asher lo yada. How do you read the lo? You have to make a choice here. Lo with a vav or a lo with an aleph? Lo with a vav. It may mean the same thing. If she was so bad, so as to prevent him from being mekayim har. In other words, I think whether you read asher lo yada lo with a vav or an aleph, you can come out with the same translation. But the way he reads it, it's clear he's reading it as a low vav.
They don't include that.
What's that?
They don't put any vowel.
On what?
The word low in this Tanakh, it just says vav and alf, so let me put.
I know, because it's a creative sieve.
Creative sieve
more. Vav and alf. Vav and alf.
Yes.
Okay? I should have said that. Be aware, the text is a creative sieve on Asher lo yada, whether it's a vav or an alf. Go ahead. Then what happens? Good. And he redeems our Vehasta, that's literal. Ligvar, there's nothing under it, it's a shvana. Ligvar.
Or
Ochran. Might be Ochran, I'm not sure. Ochran or Ochran. Now, firstly, how did that, what's he translating there? La'am Nachri. Okay. What does Am Nachri mean?
Foreign
nation. Sounds like a foreign nation. How does Uncleus translate?
A different person.
Another person, not another nation. Ibn Ezra has a comment on this now. I think in Arabic, Am can be a family. Vayeosef al Amav, by the way, means nation, might be his family. Okay? And that's relevant because there's one person whom the father can, in effect, designate her for, which is his son. But hold on. Let's see, what does Ibn Ezra say? La'am Nochri? Now, he doesn't offer some type of interpretation, but I believe that there may be actually another Semitic usage where I can think of actually in Ugaritic for sure, where there are cases of Am as probably family, a very local family. So he translates Ligvar Ukhran. This is already Chazal's tradition. Don't think that you can't sell to a foreign nation, you can sell to another person. Okay, Lethle Rishu means, well, what is that a translation of? Okay, he has no permission. Okay, he translates as Lo Yimshol. He has no permission. He doesn't rule over in the sense of having the right to live. Zabuna. Okay, he's got to have a dagish in the basis to sell. Okay, and finally, what does Mevig Dovah mean? One of the great ambiguities that's discussed in the Smechulta and in the Kidmar Kiddushin. What does Mevig Dovah mean? It's a machlokas, three machlokas atanayim. What's learned from here is that the father may not sell his daughter after he has done one of two things to her, or perhaps either. Either after he has sold her once, or after he has married her off once. What does Mevig Dovah mean? Two possibilities. What does Vigdo mean? It either means the word you'd recognize, but not the one that makes more sense in Pshat, is his Deged. His Deged. However, the Pshat probably is his betrayal of her. By having not been married her, he has betrayed her, and therefore he may not sell her to somebody else. So anyway, how does he interpret that here? The selling. It seems the Vigdo Ba, but Mishlite Ba. Okay. What I'm asking is, which does it? Is it dealing treacherously, or is it his garment? According to Uncas, what does the mishlatei ba mean? Is his having dominated her, ruled over her? It's not clear. It is more likely to lean towards
to betray.
Okay, more likely to mean to betray. Continue 9. Pasuk Tetes. I should mention, by the way, one other great ambiguity in that regard of this pasuk. When it says, Vayika yom azeh, Vayavo habaisa lasos melachto, Vein ish me'an shem vayisham abayit. So what is Vayavo habaisa lasos melachto? Rav Shmuel charamar melachto mamish, v'charamar lasos tracha ima. Right? Either to really literally do this work or to engage in an appropriate behavior with Ashes Potiphar. One of the things I suspect that is a deliberate double entendre of the pasuk there is that what happens to, what does Ashes Potiphar do? To say who? Vivigdo. What does that mean? Does it mean she grabbed him by his garment, or she grabbed him or caught him in his act of treachery? Okay, anyway. I understand the fact is he finally came to be bogeyed in his master, right? He came to be bogeyed in his master finally. He's finally given in, and now he's responsible. So she grabs him at that time, the big dough. Right. What's that? No, I mean that seriously. I think that the ambiguity is there. Shot, I think, means the garment. Pshat is the garment, but I think that there's certainly lexical ambiguity, and I would say it's not necessarily unintentional. I think that the fact that you have a machlokas Rav and Shmuel tells you that the man dama who read it as lasis trecha ima might have picked up on that nuance. Pshat means the garment, but you can have pshat and also a second layer intended. Right. Okay, continue. I would tell you, Adi, if I meant it as per term. Okay, but I don't take it personally. Go ahead. Yekaimina. If the imlev no ye odena. Ya'aved law. What does it mean? It means to do. Ya'aseh law. So that's simply kimishpat habanos. Which banos? Benas Yisrael. Okay, continue.
Nisa
Ima feres yikaf le. And yikaf, when it's used by a person, is normally used as yad ber. Okay? Usually, or yidvar, it might be a pa'al, of dalabay's race, which means to lead. Except when you use in the context of marriage, then you use the standard translation of yikaf. Okay? Yisav le. So then, what's his obligations? Okay, so what is he not allowed to withhold here? Notice it translates yigra yinah, withhold. Okay, it's supposed to reduce, but that's what it means when you withhold when you hold back something, you are in effect reducing. He's not only prohibited. Targum doesn't mean to say that only if you totally withhold it. What is the yunah? A share in that pasuk, share tsusona. Tsus is the only one that's absolutely clear and is, I believe, uniformly agreed upon by the Tanaim. There are different interpretations of what share and ona are. You probably know the standard one, which I believe is what Targum is following here, which is the sheira is mizona, the yunah, our sustenance. And the anasa is her zman, her tashmish. Okay, finally, the in.
The in, kibas,
Elaine.
Elaine,
lo yaveh. Could be yaveh. There is no segel, by the way. Patach is in place of patach and segel. I don't think there was a segel. I'm not sure there's a segel in Aramaic in general. Okay?
The
law to stop. Okay. One second. The first time it occurred to me, how did you read the law to stop? The sipok magan means yatachina, and that's straightforward. The lo kisaf. Because I don't think kisaf means money. It means to embarrass. It means that because he had no shame. That's very weird. The question is, where does kisaf appear in the Torah? But I want to understand the money. What's that? All right, let's see. How does he translate him? Kesef halvasami. Good. Okay. One second. Let me just see him. Kesef halvasami. Now, he translates kaspa. I wonder whether or not. What's that? Let's see a second. Kesef shloshim shkalim. How does it translate that? There he is. Kesef shell. That's ksaf plus. And I don't know. I have to find out. I would expect this in the law ksaf. What's that? I have to think about that for a second. Does he have anything on the bottom here? He has the law. That makes me feel better, actually. I don't know what manuscripts those are. Below Kesaf makes sense. Below Kesaf. I'm surprised that it's still not Kaspa, but okay. Fine. That's Unklus. Let's take a look. We don't have much time, but let's take a look briefly at the Pseudo-Jonathan, okay, which is... Okay, I'm gonna take the liberty of reading here. The Elaine, page 38. The Elaine Hinon Sidre Dinaya Vitasar Kodamehon, or Vitasar Kodamehon. You have already have Sidre Dinaya. This may be along the lines of Shulchan Aruch, Shulchan Aruch Bifnehem. Ki Sikne Evidri Are Tizbon, Bignevu Sei. Right, he adds in here from the Mechilta, this is an Eved HaNimkar B'Gnevaso, not an Eved HaMocher Satzmo. Okay, Uvashviyis, he translates, Uvima'alei Shavi Yisa. What does Ma'alei Shavi Yisa mean? What does Ma'alei Shabbat mean? Yeah, how does it mean that? What?
Coming in.
Yeah, that's Ayin Lamed Lamed. Uvema'alei Shabbata, right? That's the Ayin Lamed Lamed root. The mem is just a prefix, right? Like the prefix of every of present tenses, frequently found in Aramaic. 38 in the source sheet. On the left column, where it says Mishpatim. Then you have in Pasuk Dalid, so he tells you, by the way, Uva Shvius, when in the Shvius? When, by the way, is Shemitah stop and take place? Beginning or end of the Shvius?
End.
End of the Shvius. Here, Utvamale Shviyasa, the beginning of Shvius, the Eved goes free. Okay. Where are you?
In
Bilchodoy Yer, Bilchodoy Yipopi,
in
Mari. What?
In Israel?
Yeah, that's standard in Aramaic. Well, certainly you found the Aramaic. Yes. Okay, I should. In. Yes, in means. Forget it. Okay, those who caught it, caught it. Maybe it's nobody. Never mind. Pasuk Dalet in Ribone, Yitele, Ita Amsa. Okay, in Adonav Yitele, we shot. It's spelled that, it's an Amma Ivriya. Pasuk Hey. Im Omar, I'm sorry. Amsa means an Amna Amavri. It means Daphne Shif Kananis. I'm misusing the. V'im Yasne V'yemar Abda Pasuk Hey. What is Unklus doing? What is your son doing there? In Yasne, what is Yasne V'yemar Abda? Yeah, what does Yasne mean? No. Yishne. If he says it twice, the Mechilta says in Amar Yomar Evan, the Evan has to say twice, Ahafti Asenis Yishis Banai. He has taken that and incorporated it into the translation. Then Yasne V'yemar Avda. He adds it also, Pasuk Vav, V'karvinei V'bonei L'kadam Dayanaya, V'yitav Nihon Rishusa. Rashi already quotes the Mechilta there. Why does he bring him to the Dayanim? Because the Dayanim sold them in the first place. If you want to extend the Avdus, you have to get Rishus from the Dayanim. Later in the Pasuk, he says, Udne Yamina, the right ear. Another brush in the Mechilta. Now, one of the great ambiguities, Lo Tse 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 Avadim, well, before that, Pasuk Zayin, Va'arum Yizabein Gevar Bar Yisrael Yasbrate Zirta. What does it say here? Meaning, a father can only sell a katana, not a bogeres. Le'amru lo tipok kimafkanu avdaya kina anoe. What? Let us lo tsei kisei savadim. So Rashi quotes from the Mechilta there, she's not yotzeis b'shein v'ayin, like an Eved Kanani. That's what the Torah is telling you. That's why he incorporates it. Dimishtachun b'shinaya v'eina. Okay, and then he lists off the things that she's yotzei with. Shnin de shmitza, which is, by the way, a tremendous chiddush that she goes out in the shmita year. Yovo, yeah. V'simanaya uv'yova v'misa sribana upuron taspa. All the way she can be free. I don't know if the Bavli has this business of Shemitah. Okay, then, in lo hashtachas kina kadam ribonah, she doesn't find favor in the eyes of her master. That's imra abein adoneha. That's a loose translation. Asher lo yada bizabein yasa, that he sold her, or it could be that purchased bizabein yasa, probably bizabein yasa. Which means it's a reference to whom? Probably the father. The father sold her. V'yifrok yasa avua, and her father redeems her. Okay, that's how he interprets the hefda. So then who's not allowed to sell her? L'gvar uchran, that's like Onklus, this very common tradition. Lesme reshu lezabuna, chalaf demane mara reshu seleh. He's not allowed to sell her. Notice again that tradition of lo yimshol, as Leslie Rishu. You often have common Targumic traditions on how to interpret certain words that go across various Targumim. And the rest is similar to Unklus. Okay, now...
How do you translate those words?
Biglal.
Right, I know that one.
Why is he... Mara, is he bitter? No, her master. That he has appointed a master over her.
Oh, you're right.
Now, if you skip now, I want to skip to my favorite example, same page, but across, it's backwards.
Why would they use different, why would he have different
words than Unklus?
He uses
Targum instead of like the Ram or something like that?
That's dialect. That's probably dialect. Yeah, Pasuk 11. V'im shloshela, in plus milaya ha'ilein, lo yavela. That's v'im shloshela lo yasela. That's straight three things. Now, what three things? It's the same page. It's just the right column. It goes out of order. It's a little confusing. The book is published in English direction, even though it's Hebrew. What three things, by the way? Before you look at this, let me tell you the following. There are two pshat in the Mechilta. When you read the Mechilta says in Imshlash Eile, Sher Ksus Va'ona. That's one of them. The other is, well, let me see. Well, before we do it, let me just see if we have this Mechilta. Because I want you, excuse me, I want you to realize what Mechilta is actually saying. Hold on. I think we do. We do. Okay, turn to page 46. Second page 259, second paragraph on the bottom. The imshlashe lo yasala ye lecha o levincha o pedei. These are the three things that if he didn't do tar, she goes out free without any monetary payments. If he was miyai, did the girl for himself, for his son, or help redeem her. Ata oner ye lecha o levincha o pedei. Is that what it really means? So eno ela sheira ksusa honasa. The previous pasuk says sheira ksusa honasa lo yigra. The imshlashe lo yasala. So you might, do you think maybe it's referring to Sher Ksus Va'ona? Amris in davar amar la'bivriya, umat ha'malomar v'im shalash eyle, yiyeh lecha o levincha o pedei. It's talking about the ama, it's not talking about the wife, the woman he married. Okay, the woman he married, he has to provide Sher Ksus Va'ona for. His ama ibriya, he doesn't. So the first, this paragraph in the Chilta clearly understands v'im shalash eyle refers to yiyeh lecha, yiyeh levincha o pedei, not to Sher Ksus Va'ona. And what is the scenario that it's talking about? It's a case where the owner wasn't miyayed her. He wasn't miyayed her to his son. He didn't help redeem her. Eventually she goes free without having to pay anything. Does she require a get in this case? No, because they weren't married. Look at the next paragraph. Yatzachinam. Shom'ani chinam min haget. Umani mekayim chosav lasefer kvisus. Bishar anoshim chutz me'evriya. Oh, be'evriya. Talmud lomar v'im shlosh eila. Chinam me'akesef alo chinam me'haget. Does anybody have any with this Mechilta saying? No, probably not actually. Because then you wouldn't have drawn the analogy to Bishar Chasav Sefer Krisus is Bishar Nashim. One might have thought that if the girl is married off through Yiyud, because it's not a normal marriage, that you don't require a get. So the Mechilta says that you do. V'yotach chinam min chasav, chinam min hakesef, v'chol chinam min haget. How do they know that in fact that she that it's talking about that she requires a get? It says Tama Lomar V'im Shlosh Eila. How is the Mechilta interpreting V'im Shlosh Eila here? Sherek Ksus Va'ona of someone, of a girl he married. In other words, Sherek Ksus Va'ona Solo Yigra V'im Shlosh Eila. These three Sherek Ksus Va'ona Lo Yasela Then V'yatzachim Amin Kasef. He's obligated to divorce her. She goes out, but she needs a get. She was married. So these are two contradictory interpretations of Im Shlosh Eila in the Mechilta. When you look in Targum Sudra Jonathan, he says, Im Shlosh Milaya even Liyadila, Lemizmena Yosale, O Livre, O Lemifrake, Liyadavuha, Vitipuk Magan Delo Kisa, Biram and Get Pitur and Yayatla. This is a case of a doublet within the Targum, when he's interpreting what are essentially two conflicting interpretations, almost not paying attention to the fact that they're conflicting. Now, did he realize that they conflict, or did he interpret differently? I don't know. It's clear to me that these two paragraphs in the Mechilta interpret for Im Shlosh Eila as referring to two different things. And yet, funny enough, the Targum has a doublet which he incorporates both interpretations. Okay. Turn two last passages in the Targum that we'll look at. One is the Neo 50, turn the page to 39. Pasuk 8. Or actually, go to two, three things. Pasuk Vav, O the Mezuz Yasa, okay, is literal. Not like even in that case, unklus incorporated the halacha, incorporated the halacha of the mechilta there, and Neofiti does not. He takes it literally. Pasach Zayin lo se seket seisa avadim. Interesting, he has benimuse avadaya. What are nimusim? No. Close, but not quite. What is antinomian? What is nomos in Greek? What is antinomian? No one knows what nomos is?
Nomos.
Law. Christianity is an antinomian religion. Right? It's against the law. Right, it doesn't believe in law. That was Paul's the quote attributed to Paul. The letter of the law killeth, the spirit giveth life. Right, that's Christianity is very anti. You wouldn't know that necessarily today. Very anti-legalistic. Right? Nomos, nimusim are laws. Okay. Finally, Pasuk 8. How does he translate la'am nachri ligvar bar amamin? What does that mean? That's la'ish nachri. It's not. Nachri he takes literally, am he doesn't. One more, and by the way, his bevig dova is halafi haver shusa ale. What is that? Maybe. That already could come closer to being bevig dova, paras paliso aleha. Maybe. But granted, maybe not. Okay, finally, the last targum to look at is the pshita. Turn to page 40. Pasuk Ches, Insanya hi beinei mara. That she is hated in the eyes of her master. Hateful. Vila nasvei. That he did not marry her. Notice there, he already has lamed aleph, not lamed vav. Nifrike. He should redeem her, or we should redeem her. La'am nochri. He translates. Doesn't translate. He just takes it literally. Lo shalif la, he doesn't rule over her. That's, by the way, much closer to. I never thought of that. That's lo yimshal. It's almost as if la mishla tebe is under the influence of lo yimshal early. I don't know why that never occurred to me. Okay, lo shalif la, here, this makes sense. He's interpreting it as lo yimshal. Lemizabanusa, to sell her. Mital, and you know what mital means? No. That means the prefix. You have amtu. Now, actually, is that the same thing? You may have a word amtul in Babylonian Aramaic. I'm not sure, but metal is bishvil mifnei. Did the galba? Anyone want to guess what the galba means? This is clear. It means to abel treacherously. He takes the bigova clearly as bagat. Okay. By the way, for the most part, the rest of this. Of the pshita is almost literal translation. Even if you look at the first pasuk of the halein dina or dina vitasim kadeveihom. Okay. All right. So next week, I told you at the beginning what you needed to do. I hope to have your exams. If I don't.